Karen has worked in public and global health for over 25 years. She was the director of the Global Health Track for the University of Colorado School of Medicine, teaches in the Global Health Global Studies program at University College at the University of Denver, and has worked with Centura Health Global Health Initiative and Child Family Health International.
Thank you very much. So, thank you all for being here. My talk is a little bit different than what we've heard, but it's looking more at the paradigm shift of using systems thinking in how we might think about global health education. Now, if I step away, can you all hear me? Because that still work. Okay. Okay. I'm gonna try to hear. So I do have a disclosure. I am a consultant for Child Family Health International, which is a nonprofit program that does study abroad type programs that has UN special funding. If we think about systems thinking, and I put this slide up because I think it's quite fascinating to think about it through the engineering kind of side and then think about what our presenters have presented and then go with the global health education. An MIT professor first kind of put this idea out there in 1956 as a new way of testing ideas through a social system. Okay, so systems thinking focuses on how the thing being studied interacts with the other constituents. And in a paper I looked up, just we're going to take this, pesticide application. If we apply a pesticide to insect A, because the insect A is eating all of our plants, and the pesticide takes away insect A, that's great. But the impact might be that insect A was keeping down the population of insect B, which now that insect A is gone, insect B is overpopulating, and they also have an impact on our plants. So it's very cyclical, the very system, it's all very connected. As Dr. Luboga's talk very much identified, we do one thing that actually probably did a lot of good, but there's all these other pieces that weren't brought into the table and thought about initially. So my challenge is, how do we step back before we do a program, before we train our students, before we go do something, and think about all those different components and how they might interact? It's very relational. So systems thinking is relational, and if we think about global health education and curriculum delivery, it's very relational, and yet that's probably not what we're doing in the United States right now. Global health is defined by the Western lens. How many of you identify with pictures like this? So we have the volunteers. We've got a lot of U.S. individuals traveling internationally. We have, we are the solution. And in this context, this slide is saying we, the Western world, is the solution. How many of you actually work in some type of global health education or curriculum delivery? Anybody? A few of you, okay. So the idea is, maybe not those of you in this room, but there's a paradigm out there that we know best, and we're going to fix it. And the challenge is, that's probably not the best way to do anything. So, Jeffrey Copeland put this definition out at a recent, in the Consortium of Universities of Global Health. A field of study, research, and practice that places the priority of achieving equity in health for all people globally. Global health involves multiple disciplines within and beyond the health sciences. It's a synthesis of population-based prevention with individual-level care, clinical care, and promotes interdisciplinary collaboration and emphasizes transnational health issues and determinants. Equity, all people, multiple disciplines, synthesis, collaboration, and transnational. So how often, when we think about global health education, are we thinking about that intersection of our students, our universities, with other students and other universities? Or is it that we're just going to drop in someplace? Same with our research. And I have to say, I've been a faculty member. I've had my own research projects. I've worked with some of our federal agencies. And the challenge is, how much are we partnering? I liked this graphic just because it really kind of puts this context in that everything is very much interrelated. The moment I change one system or go in and do one thing, I've impacted many other components. So let's talk about global health education. This is from the Chronicle of Higher Education from the November 12, 2012 issue. And it really describes from 1996 up to 2011, the U.S. students studying abroad and the different kinds of programs that are going on. Now, we can see that there's a dramatic increase in the number of students over the last 5-10 years. We can also see that even the blue, which is the long-term or full academic or calendar year, that really hasn't seen much change. We've seen a little bit of change in the yellow, which is the lower context, and that's mid-length, so one semester or one or two quarters. But those shorter-term programs, maybe a summer or 8 weeks or less, have grown dramatically. How many of you have students that are going internationally, that want to go internationally? Most of you. Where are they going? This is from the same article. Okay. This article shows that U.S. students traveled to these places, the red being the higher numbers. So a lot going to Europe. I venture to say that that's our business students, right? And then we've got students traveling to South America, to Asia. Not much is showing up in Africa. But I want to caution us here that these are statistics from formal study abroad programs where students getting from the United States to a lot of the African countries have a lot of barriers. I know that we have a lot of faculty that do a lot of research, and we have a lot of international programs that are happening in Africa, and I have taken students to Africa myself, but we're not capturing it. So even this graphic is a little bit distorted. But then the question is, how many students from the rest of the world are traveling the rest of the world? Not necessarily coming to the United States, although that's important too. Where are students from around the world traveling? And do we have graphics of that? How is that global citizenship being made? With Child Family Health International, we have data that looks at why and the motivations of the students that are traveling with us that are not all U.S. students. A majority are. Why are they traveling and what's their motivation? Clearly, this graphic shows that the importance of wanting to explore a different culture, of wanting to help people in need, and to gain practical experience are the key reasons and motivations for students wanting to travel. I'm going to posit that that would be true for students all over the world. And yet, we don't create opportunities, or those opportunities for students to travel internationally, bidirectionally, isn't really set up. So when we think about global health education through this relational lens, okay, how do we teach our students about global health, and how do we create these global experiences? So a typical way that we might teach would be lectures. And there's lots of different things that happen in the classroom. I can stand up and lecture and tell you all about country X or tell you my trip to India, and it's this. Then there's using multimedia. So through the different documentaries that are out there, when our students travel, having them actually create videos, lots of different ways, using social media to interact, using Skype, having classroom in Nairobi, Skyped into a classroom in Denver. So there's ways to do that. Research. Clearly we've heard a lot about different research programs. Many of you are doing research programs. Are students traveling with you? Now, there's challenges with that, right? You got to get them on board. They have to understand the research. Then they have to understand the countries that we're taking them to. And then they have to actually be functional with us. That's not going to happen with a younger student or a student that we only know for a quarter or a semester. So that decreases some of the opportunities there. Interactions with the other. And I'm going to put that other out there because there's a paradigm around the other. If you're different than what I look like, you're other. Because in the United States, we don't actually challenge that power and privilege idea. It's not really taught very well. So we teach our students about global health in a lot of different ways. We can get very creative. One of the best ways we think about is let's send them somewhere or let them travel somewhere. I also challenge my global health students in that global health isn't just over there. It's right here. We walk out the door of any of our universities and we have populations that have a lot of differences between them. And there's so much that we can learn, right? So as far as creating global experiences, faculty are traveling. Study abroad programs are happening from our universities. But again, the challenge of creating those opportunities is very fraught with a lot of different challenges. We've got time issues, we've got money issues, we've got resource issues. There are third-party vendors, is what kind of talked about out there, NGOs that are set up to actually create opportunities for students. We have faith-based systems that are out there creating opportunities for students. But how does it all impact the country that those individuals are going to and the United States? So as I was thinking about this presentation and trying to kind of talk about how to use systems thinking within the context of global health education and curriculum, the paradigm is that there's some things that we need to think differently from the get-go, not once our students are somewhere else or not why we're thinking about creating a study abroad program. How does that concept of power and privilege impact? There's a case study that's written and published by Jessica Evert and Mary White that looks at a dynamic of a professor. It's a made-up story. It's a made-up case study. But you've got a dean of a school who's met an individual from this made-up place in Kenya, a hospital in Kenya. And the dean meets this gentleman at a conference. And then there's a student at the U.S. medical school that wants to go study abroad. Okay. And she says, I want to go to Africa, I want to learn about new diseases that I can't see in the United States, I want to go and learn things and do things that I can't do here in the United States. Problem number one there is really we should be learners when we're traveling and we shouldn't be doing things there that we can't do here. Then there's in this made-up case study, there's a faculty member at this university where the dean has met someone, and the dean says to this faculty member, I would very much like you to go and set up a global project with this gentleman I met over at this hospital in Kenya. So it's all set up, and the case study presents four different scenarios. You've got the U.S. medical student that's going over, and she's going to get money if she does some research. You've got the mid-level faculty member who's been asked by his dean to go over and create a program. You've got the director of a hospital over in Kenya, and then you've got a nursing student. And this nursing student is in the Kenya hospital, and she ultimately ends up taking care of the U.S. medical student. And so the dynamics of what's happening are quite interesting. So the professor from the United States that goes over wants to do genetic research. The guy on the ground is very interested in creating a medical school. So the two pieces are like ships passing in the night. The research student wants to do something about healthcare workers and pediatrics, but when the nurse takes her out to the field, the healthcare workers are only working with adults. Okay, so what are the systems and how can we set up the design to actually think about those bigger pictures before we take students out in the field? The privilege and power that as U.S. educated individuals as we walk off the plane is huge. Another piece is this interaction framework. Most of the time we think about a deficit model. What's the problem and how can we fix it? Versus an asset model, which is really looking at the resources available in country. And how do we think about that in the partnership? We actually have to go and spend time there and think about those things. Other challenges are finances. Our students in the United States, a majority of the students traveling are not of minority descent, okay? And so there's challenges even within the students that are traveling from the United States to other countries. But then the challenge is how do we get students from other countries the opportunity to travel globally as well, whether that's to the United States or to another country. Safety becomes an issue. And
how do we as parents and faculty and universities create those opportunities in places that have, that are safe? I love going to Kenya and Tanzania, and yet with the recent State Department warnings, how do we take our students? We can't necessarily do that. Time and educators to create and to think systematically about what's happening and how those dynamics play out. If we think about systems thinking, a couple of points here. Static thinking, so the usual approach, versus systems thinking. Dynamic thinking, framing a problem in terms of a pattern of behavior over time. I'm going to posit that every time we think about global health education and curriculum, we actually have to think from a higher level on the paradigms that we're thinking through before we do anything. If we go down to operational thinking, concentrating on causality and understanding how a behavior is generated, just this challenge of thinking through why we are traveling, what's the motivation and what are we doing? Is it to create an opportunity? Is it to create a global citizen? What's the big picture? As was presented by all of my colleagues, what's the outcome? And what are the components that might fit into that outcome? Yep. This is the last slide. This is just two programs where my students that I was involved in. One is student from University of Colorado training promotores in up the stream in the Amazon, so working with local individuals trying to create sustainability. And this is where we have students from Lima paired with students from the University of Colorado, again, working in the field, so building the bridges. So thank you for your time.
Oh, great. Yeah. Thank you, Karen. We have time for questions from the audience. Any of the concepts about systems thinking in general, anything in particular you'd like to bring up about any of the presentations? I was trained to be comfortable with pauses. Okay, thanks. So her question is, on the PEPFAR project, how are you able to measure the transition from PEPFAR funded to country ownership?
Yes, we are not yet doing a good job of transition. In fact, we are worried sick about what will happen if Congress puts a stop on this funding right now, because we have so many people on antiretroviral therapy and it is totally free to the patient, and it is very expensive treatment, and we are starting to see failed first line treatment patients needing to go on the second line treatment, and that is even more expensive. We hope that in time we'll grow our economy, but that will take some time. But what concerns us is that it has been shown that if you invest enough money, you can get enough people to work very determinedly and bring down the epidemic. But that's not the only epidemic we have. That's not the only problem we have. So can we take the lessons from AIDS to affect the rest of the healthcare problems? Therefore, do we need a Marshall Plan? Because other people who do not have HIV/AIDS also need a treatment. So it is a very complex situation, and maybe my friend can add something.
So that's an interesting, just for the record, I'll say, summarize that Amy is mentioning that country ownership needs to be defined as government ownership in order to make sure that government is accountable to the people and that we invest in those, help government invest in strengthening those systems. I was just at a TAG meeting, a technical advisory group for USAID for supply chain. And it's interesting because we defined country ownership more broadly, including the people of the country, which if you define country ownership to include not just working with government, but working with civil society organizations, community-based organizations, and the people, you're recognizing that sometimes you need to put pressure on government to do what they're supposed to do, and that the voice of the people can come in many ways, and that maybe that would also help to increase these investments in capacity building. But I'd like to hear if anybody else has thoughts or ideas. Panelists? Anybody? Other questions? Yes.
By the way, I work with Sarah Cagulli and my office.
Yeah.
And with some of the funds of the family medicine stuff that we gave this year as well. There were two great common themes, I think, from this. And your paper was like wonderful. The first theme, of course, is that no one listens to the population in any way, shape, form, or manner before they do programs. And if you do top-down programs, the people at the bottom who are supposed to implement the programs will never buy in or identify with what's going on. That applies to the first two presentations. The Advanced Science Conference. Oh, it's Jeff Stone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, competition. That was a big fight that's over, though, there. So the John Stone, the idea, and then it brings me to Jack Geiger's idea when he was in Mississippi and Mount Bayou, and he started writing prescriptions for food. And they said, well, why do you write prescriptions for food? Well, because the people are hungry, and that's the cure for hunger. Okay? And so, you understand the distinction there between the other theme, of course, is not understanding the difference between medicine and health. Okay? And so that's a common theme, and that's a problem with the PEPFAR program and all of those programs. Okay, not only don't they ask, and these are not, by the way, the end of the joke, let me just tell you the end of the joke, PEPFAR is a joke, right? Because it made things worse. Everybody knew that was going to happen from the beginning. I was in a meeting with Chen, and he said, don't tell anybody. He was in charge of the PEPFAR programs in East Africa originally. He said, don't tell, this is at Citibank, and they were trying to fund that Tanzania hospital. And he says, don't tell anybody, but we've just destroyed the public health infrastructure in Tanzania. The because 100 of the 300 community health district doctors are now looking for PEPFAR. So everybody knew this was going to happen, but the end of the joke is, as you didn't say, HIV rates are increasing again in Uganda, and my view of the reason for that is because treatment is thought to be available, and the main driver of prevention was fear, and now we have undermined fear of catching HIV, and so nobody's doing what they needed to do, and the main health drivers that, of course, no U.S. programs deal with are education, women's empowerment, food, sanitation, and health. Security, food, sanitation, those are the drivers of health. We don't deal with them because we don't think about them in the West because they're assumed to be done by other people. And so we go in and deliver medicine or medical care and make things worse. And this is just
thank
crazy.
You. Really important contribution. Yes.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I have two questions. One, how do you really give us a logical explanation of how PEPFAR affects the United Children of Libya? What's the logical kind of explanation to say? Some effect, especially when it comes to the United Nations and Libya, I'm not going to give your explanation. And the other is, how do you really attribute PEPFAR's investment in some of the reduction that you see? It is a very difficult kind of attribution to say really PEPFAR to blame or to be PEPFAR had effect in terms of some of the
okay. I'd like to wait just a moment and get the last question and maybe we can see. Lydia, did you have
it? Yeah, I did. It was the book authors, and I just wondered if your book provided some feasible solutions for increasing social spending and
increasing
well, that should take about 10 seconds.
I
should
have just signed. Okay, do you
want to
go first?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I will jump up. I think we were actually very careful in the book, and I hope you'll read it, to not suggest greater spending in social services, but rather think about how can we create the kind of joint incentives to have the spending we do in health accomplish and target some of the social determinants of health and be held accountable for some of the social determinants of health. Just politically, we thought that was the most strategic approach we could use.
Can I ask a piggyback question? So what's the ideal ratio?
Well, Sweden is 2-1. Sweden has the best health outcomes at the, dollar per life saved. Sweden is, rocking through the world and has for several years, and it's 2-1. So, I don't know. And I don't think there is an ideal. Obviously, it has to sort of be in the culture of the community. And I think the same dollar, it depends how it is incentivized. So we could call it a healthcare dollar, we could call it a social care dollar, but if it is rewarded for dealing with the social determinants of health, whichever bucket it is, I think it can work. Good, thanks.
Like prescriptions for food.
Exactly, that's in the book, and so is Guy. Let
Dr. Lubaga have the last comment about answering the PEPFAR question.
Well, thank you very much. As you know, there are many parallels to this. It is like you go there to do an experiment and it is already done for you, and all you are doing is read the data. Because we are using routinely collected data. We did not set out to do a comparative study of investment versus not investment. And what we did was we found the data from PEPFAR that allowed us to categorize the districts and the health units in terms of low, medium, and high investment. And then we knew there would be confounding factors. That's why we tried to account for the effect of art plus sanitation, art plus enrollment in school, and a whole bunch of other things. And we line by line, we found that when we accounted for those things, it was consistent that levels of investment were behaving differently. This is not exact attribution. This is related attribution, and we think it is looking like that more and more, and it is within the period where so much investment was from PEPFAR. We do not claim that this is exact, but that's what it is looking like. But with the malaria is very endemic in Uganda, and most people are treated for malaria whenever they have fever. But in situations where you are on antiretroviral therapy, you are also being highly monitored for other things, and temperatures are more quizzed when you are on antiretroviral in order to find out, are you getting a reaction or do you have something else? And I think we don't know exactly what is happening with malaria. For example, we do not take into account all the preventive strategies for malaria, but we are seeing that where there's a lot of investment in PEPFAR, there are more tests of malaria. I mean, do you have any?
I would just add that the workforce issue is not trivial. That is, as I mentioned, that we definitely did the transfer of health workers to the private sector, which does distract health workers from taking care of
I want to thank everybody for coming, for your thought-provoking questions and synthesis comments. Thank you very much to the panel for their provocative presentations and interesting insights. And I wish you all a great afternoon, and bring systems thinking into every session that you go to. Thanks.
Thank you.